This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Lindsay Clancy, lots to go through here. Conspiracy and confusion. That's what I want to address. Literally, I'm going through the comments of you guys over the last several weeks directly from our YouTube. I've copied many of them into my teleprompter and document here that we're going to work through. And we're going to go through various theories, various observations, misunderstandings, confusion, because there's a lot of it here in this case, where at the end of the day, I don't care what you land on, whether you think and believe that Lindsay Clancy was someone who did this and was completely understanding of what she was doing, or if you think she was psychotic. What I do care about is that you're getting there based on fact and based on truth, and not based on conspiracy or just flat-out confusion, because there's so much out there with it. Lindsay Clancy admits she killed her three children. That's one fact both sides of this trial agree on. And somehow it's the fact getting buried under everything else. Patrick did it. The knife was set down by a left-handed man. She fled the country. He fled the country. I mean, these things just are, they're not based on reality. There's a rope on the bedroom door. She never heard a voice until her lawyer needed one. Again, those things I just stated, these are things that are out there in the ether being presented as fact. Some have nuggets of fact attached to them. Some are not at all. Every one of those claims is circulating right now, and every one of them has an answer on the trial record. This is, like I said, Lindsay Clancy, conspiracy and confusion. We're pulling some of the comments straight from this channel, the ones with the most traction and the most confidence, and we're checking each claim against what was actually said under oath in Plymouth Superior Court. What you decide about Lindsay Clancy is yours. Guilt, insane, failed by doctors, all three. Reasonable people are landing in very different places. Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, is with me as always to help us do just this. I'm just going to jump into one here. I'm going to read it verbatim, and then we can kind of to parse through some of the claims being made.
And Tony, before you do, quick, I want to first, let's before we start diving into the first one, let's give some, again, we've said this throughout this case, I want to give everyone a methodology to think about these things.
Okay.
We have an amazing audience, and I've really come to respect the critical thinking in our audience. So I want to remind everyone, when you see or get information, what my process is and what a critical thinking process, especially in this world of true crime, that is, one, if you come up with an idea or theory, the number one thing I think you should start trying to do is find facts and data to disprove it. Secondly, if you hear a competing fact or theory that you don't agree with, find facts and data that would prove it. This keeps your brain constantly in motion, trying to find real facts and data free of confirmation bias. And then, if you keep landing on your theory and it's going very well and you have facts and data and you can't disprove it and you're seeing other data, look for opportunities to correct yourself and be wrong along the path. Like I told Jennifer yesterday on the show, I said, my number one goal amongst many goals is I get excited when I am proving myself wrong and I evolve my opinion of things, because that proves to me I'm critical thinking. So I just want everyone to remain critical thinking. If you hear something, don't dismiss it. Don't celebrate it. Let's investigate it. So with that, Tony, I'm sorry. Let's go.
No, I agree. That's a great way of looking at it. Challenge your beliefs. Try and look at it from the angle of you possibly being wrong, because believe it or not, we can be wrong.
Then the last question you ask yourself, what would it take for me to change my mind? And then before you even go any further, write it down. It's like, I have on this case, I have a list of things it would take for me to change my mind. It's very articulate. That way, if you start seeing them, in your, if you don't have them written down, you can dismiss them. Well, I still think this. No, no, no. You actually set a criteria for yourself. Let's analyze that criteria. So with that.
All right. We're going to try and get through as many of these as we can. We're going to start with the conspiracy confusion and did she do it area, basically, because, again, somehow this is up for litigation on the internet, not in the actual trial. This is not a whodunit case at all, but some are treating it that way. So let's start with this. This is the comment. Quote, there is blood outside the window like she's trying to escape. And apparently there's a rope around the bedroom door. How do you explain that? If she cut her wrists and was trying to commit S, why would you need a rope then? I don't think she was trying to commit S. I think she was trying to get rope off her hand that he did and was trying to frame her for all the murders so he could be with his mistress. These are the comments that make my head want to explode. But I want to tackle them because people read these who don't know anything about the case and go, there's a mistress, there's a rope. No, there's actually none of those things. None of those things are part of this case. Let's just start. Blood outside the window like she's trying to escape. It came from her going out the window. The state police analyst Sherry Crook testified the stains on the sill and shingles were transfer stains, contact with something bloody. Both sides agree. She went out of there herself. The only fight in court was whether she jumped or slid down. There's no rope. There's just no rope. That's not in the testimony, not in the evidence. It's not, there's no rope. So if you're hearing anything about a rope, just know that that's completely made up.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything about a rope either. I have watched every minute of the testimony throughout this entire case. And so there's a few things here. So again, let's investigate it. Let's try to prove this right. And so the things that don't allow us to prove it right is one, there's no facts and data in there that are accurate. So we can't utilize any of that. And here's what I'm looking for accuracy. I'm looking for testimony in this case because we are, and a lot of times we're covering cases that haven't been to trial yet. And a lot of times you're covering cases that have already been to trial. So we can use those facts and data and other things that have been leaked out on the internet that we can actually verify through multiple sources. That's what we want to do. And not just hearsay with firsthand accounts. And so in this case, haven't heard of the rope. So I don't even know where that came from, but let's look at the S attempt here.
Mm-hmm.
We have two areas to look at on this, and one of them profound and the other one massively profound to say that this was indeed a very, very serious S attempt. And that is, one, the medical examiners of her, you know, the forensic examiners of her. The injury she had was extremely congruent, extremely from wrists to neck to impact of all the internal damage of ribs, bones, organs, which paralyzed her, does not happen from sliding down the side of a building. It's only from head first into ground. That was a testimony of the medical people, strict medical people. And that's profound to me. Even more profound, though, is every single mental health provider in this entire sequence, both for the prosecution and defense, both sides, severe S ideology,
mm-hmm.
and severe attempts, one actually acted out on, and so severe that even the prosecution's forensic psychologist that's actually still on the stand as of this recording now being cross-examined by Reddington, he actually testified yesterday about how severe it is that he's very rarely seen cases where she's on one-on-one supervision for 3 years after the event. That's how severe that is. So, sliding down the side, escape, someone else doing it, I won't even give this a 0.1% probability. There's not, both on the pure physical medical side and the mental health side, there's not one person testifying, and there's not one bit of evidence that it's anything but exactly that.
What do you make of so many people going, I don't believe, it was a true S attempt. I don't believe she was S idol, all of that. It's like she's telling everyone she is. She's journaling about it. you know, but somehow the conspiracy is that Patrick was setting this all up and telling people that these are private conversations with clinicians where she's saying this before all of this happened. Patrick wasn't involved in those conversations. So for that conspiracy to work, would Patrick sit like paying off the clinicians to say, I mean, I just don't get it. When the actual person in question has said on the record 40 different ways what half of the conspiracy theorists are saying is not true. Like, the person is saying it over and over and over and over. I don't know. I mean, there's cases where it's like it's gray area. Like, maybe they said it, maybe they didn't. That's not this at all.
There's never I never give broad sweeps. Look, I use that word never, which means extreme, right?
But yeah.
I tend to not give broad sweeps of everyone in a category. But here's one thing I see for, I think, a large swath of people that have this theory of it's not her that did this. And that is, she's very compelling. So if you are on the side where you don't view her as this evil demon monster, but your mind remained open at the very beginning, and you saw her completely collapse non-verbally and verbally into herself, you hear the story of her background, her arc that has been described about her and her as a mother and as a wife and as a daughter from absolutely everyone that testified, both from the prosecution and the defense side. She's a compelling figure. And she's a figure, as Bob Mata said, our great attorney, on one of those days, the second day, he just wanted to give her a hug. So in the words of other people, you wanted to give a monster a hug? Well, yeah, for some people, she's an extremely compelling person that you can't believe would do something like that. So it must be someone else. And we will find the data to support our observations. And so hence, we're going to do what we do as human beings. We're going to see patterns where patterns do not exist. We're going to have we've come up with our conclusion. It must not be her. So now we're going to collect our confirmation bias data to support that and find a pattern that's not there. That is what happens in these cases. And that's why if we listen to all the testimony, and I thought the doctor on the stand, yes, I can't remember. I can't pronounce his name. The final witness that the defense has put up, I mean, the prosecution has put up for the rebuttal, you know, he gave two practical theories on this one. One, it was either a postpartum psychotic break, as the defense is claiming, or it was a severe S attempt with S ideology and the filicide. Well, what kind of filicide is it? Humanitarian filicide, where she thought the children would be better off dead than without her on this planet. You know, so he came up with two theories on that. So that's what you're left to entertain after yesterday's. But again, it's she's a compelling fit because, again, what's that explanation give? Both those explanations give it wasn't her in her right mind, and that's what that's why the defense is saying what it is. She in her right mind as a human being is incapable of doing these things, and I think the people that are coming up with these theories, it's Patrick, are in the same place. They just don't understand why they're at that place.
Yeah, I think you make a lot of really good points there. Specifically talking about how our minds, this has been most fascinating to me in some of our conversations with Siobhan, of just how we're getting here and finding patterns where patterns don't exist, basically to confirm
the outcome we want.
The condition that we are most comfortable with.
Right.
That's, you know, what version of this story are we going to be able to digest? And it doesn't necessarily at all come down to what was reality here, what happened in Lindsay Clancy's mind. It's what are we okay with on the outside over here, which has nothing to do with the case, of saying that this exists in our world. And that's a very, because it's such an extreme, such a horrific thing. I think a lot of people are having a really hard time dealing with reality on reality's terms, basically.
It is. I mean, our discussion yesterday was the same thing, even after being on air, you know, with Jennifer. It's like, this is a hard thing. It's a very hard thing pragmatically and objectively. And that's why we really honor the jurists in here that have the hardest job out of everyone right now, is they have to sit here and hold two things truth at the same time. The truth of the horror that this mother brutally murdered her kids, and what kind of human being can do that? At the same time, they got to try to hold, in the other hand, the fact that it wasn't her in her right mind if they're going to go with what the defense is saying. So it's a very, very hard thing to not want. As human beings, we want justice. We want retribution. We want punishment to be doled out from those people that do horrendous things. But our criminal justice system was set up for just these extremely, extremely rare situations where we're going to bring in some more harder science when we need to do it to take a closer look. And ultimately, what you and I think or what everyone in the public thinks today doesn't matter because we're not on the jury. If it ever gets retried, if she's found guilty and they all the different rebuttals they could do and retrials, you know, we know you might be on that trial. But as of right now, it's in the hands of them. And I think, as we said yesterday, watching the testimony, you know, that the prosecution, I thought, did an okay job as of right now. I think they started hitting more of a stride towards the end with some of the people they brought on board until those people fumbled by calling, saying, invoking religion as they shouldn't have done. But I'll tell you what, Reddington has thrown it all on the table. You know, if they don't side with the defense, it's not because of effort. It's not because of great testimony. It's not because of great cross. And you have to really, you have to respect the process.
Yeah. No, I agree. There's a lot of questions here. Let's get into some more of these that have come down on the did she do it again? Not what this case is litigating, but the internet is. I'm just going to read a couple of these that all kind of pertain to the same area. Have you watched the trial at all? Patrick did this. Y'all are going to regret this in the end. The evidence is atrocious. There really isn't any evidence pointing at him. Duxbury police and MSP have destroyed this case. Typical of Massachusetts. When you don't have the evidence for the theory you're going down, you're going to blame then the institutions that failed to gather it for you, I guess, by that logic. Now, look, I'm not a big fan of a lot of Massachusetts law enforcement. I think they've proven themselves quite incompetent in many cases. This case, I don't really have much of an issue with them at all. And but, you know, there's plenty of cases where there has been questions. I don't know enough to speak about this specific department, but that's an interesting way of looking at this one.
Well, there's also not much to investigate. She did it. She admitted she did it. And so you're just collecting data in a very small location. Digitally, forensically. I mean, it's not like, and full access. No one was denying anything.
Well, when someone comes up and says that the evidence is atrocious towards Patrick, they're not basing that on evidence. I mean, there's no evidence in this trial about that.
And so here's what you can really then take a look at. So if you think there's more there, and I know Bob Mott has said this, Eric Faddis has said this, we've all said this on our show, and that is you can only go and base what you have on the facts and data collected. And when you have a 50-year defense attorney who is world-renowned for investigating these things and trying these types of things as Kevin Reddington is, if there was a way, I mean, you saw, I think everyone could agree he is very, very passionate and compassionate for his defendee, for Lindsay. There's no doubt about it. If there is a way, and Bob said this too, if there is a way for him to pin this on someone else, he would have found it. There's just because we don't like his affect, just because people think he moved on too fast to marry someone else and fall in love again, or whatever he calls it. Again, this is what's hard for us. We each individually have our own context because we place ourselves in their shoes, not as them, but as us.
Yeah.
What you would do in that situation might be extremely and is extremely different than what they would do in that situation, because here's why. You grew up in a different place. You went to different education. Your reasons for falling in love with someone are different. Your definition of love is something different. Everything you need going through, I mean, how many of you of us watching have lost three children to a brutal murder by your wife? And what does that feel like? What do you need to recover from that? What kind of therapy have you been through or not been through? See, all these facts and data give us each our individual context of what is. And so, again, it comes down to who are you to judge the right and wrong of someone else's actions, especially if it's not illegal. But I know they're claiming it's illegal that he did it. But where? There's just – now, granted, I'll live in the world of maybe on absolutely everything. And if someone can – provide data, facts, and analysis that says there's a glimmer of something there that is actually not conjecture. That's not some theory to prove your point. It's just not there.
I don't he moved on to, like, there's a comment there we just saw. The speed at which Patrick met his wife and remarried does make me question her motives. It was 3 years he waited to get married. That's not a short period of time. That's three years.
You know what's interesting about that, too? I'll tell you, I'm curious about it because it's a painful thing to move on from, and it's awful. So I'm less curious about Patrick, believe it or not, on this. I'm curious about what must be going through his mind, because when you get in the world of behavioral analysis, I'm compelled to try to understand everyone that's touching this, that touches everything. That's why I'm always looking at degrees of separation, the people in your lives, the relationships, the communication, all of it. And with Patrick, the one thing that I'm really, really curious about is, yes, him, but I'm really curious about the amazing, and I only say amazing because I don't know her. I can only imagine the amazing woman it must be to subject herself to this, knowing what he's been through, knowing that he didn't fall out of love with her, but from what we've seen, we remember. So what I mean, I'm really curious. I mean, it takes a really special person to be able to do that and go through this scrutiny. So I'm a glass half full until I see something. Otherwise, I see a lot of really in this whole circle of people surrounding Lindsay. I see nothing but really caring, empathetic people. Yeah. And I haven't seen a wobble here anywhere. Matter of fact, that's the most unusual thing to me in this entire case. There's no wobble. I haven't seen a wobble yet from anyone.
That's the most frustrating part about this case is like we see wobbles in all sorts of cases all the time and nobody sees them. And this one doesn't have any, but yet everyone sees one and we're like, no, there's no wobble. It's like
I find this the other day too. It's like, how do I see things? So my 22 plus years with the FBI on my behavior team, running my behavior team, when we did a behavioral consult on a case, we are assessing the motivations, actions, and deeds of an individual, management, all these people in the circle that was surrounding this case. And what we would do is we would behaviorally observe that person over their life arc. That's where I come up with this. I mean, it wasn't just me randomly coming up with this. I mean, this was my process for how I understood people, their motivations, their likes, their wants, their interests, their priorities in life, the pain points, all those things in someone's life to understand what makes them make the decisions they do from their best interest. And then what we had is we had our operational forensic psychologist sitting with us on our team as I'm making my behavioral observations. They're then doing what we're seeing in the trial here. They're actually weighing in forensically, psychologically, science-wise to say if that makes sense or not makes sense. And so I'm very practiced at seeing wobbles, if they're real, imagine what's practical, and linking the two together. I mean, it's a lot of reps of doing this. And I'm telling you, I hate using these I statements, but for me, I have not seen a wobble in any of these circles yet, anywhere near, as a matter of fact, not even near, I haven't even seen one, but anywhere near any other case we've ever covered, even with people that were innocent. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I agree. Your thoughts in the comment section, Substack, and YouTube. Links are in the description. We'll continue it there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
The defense admitted Lindsay killed her children before the trial started. The prosecution then spent 14 days and more than 70 witnesses trying to prove premeditation. The Apple Maps search, the takeout order, the timing of when she sent Patrick out of the house. The only question the jury has to answer is whether she was criminally responsible. So essentially, they spent 2 weeks proving something that was really never that much in dispute. Joining us to discuss, we got Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. So they did spend basically 2 weeks proving something that was never much in dispute, but it was emotional. It got people crying. It got people upset. A jury, they had to go on the ride. They're there. They are along for wherever those attorneys take them. In your opinion, did anything from the prosecution land with that jury? Obviously, it's hard to know. We're not there looking at them, but just from absorbing the story that was trying to be told from the perspective of the prosecution, that she premeditated this and she had all of her wits about her while she was doing it. Was there ever a very clear line that was drawn to that, Eric?
In my experience, a lot of attorneys tend to shy away from some of the weaknesses in their case. They might have really strong evidence as to one element, but not so strong evidence as to another. And I think if you are only amplifying, one particular element and sort of ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the weaknesses in your case, you're going to have a problem. I think they were amplifying the alleged premeditation to try to, and there is some evidence that a person could interpret as supportive of premeditation, certainly. But even if we assume that they prove the premeditation piece, they still got this huge issue to resolve regarding whether she knew right from wrong. A person could theoretically plan something, but still not be in the right mind, not know right from wrong, but still engage in planning steps. So I think they focused way too long on what they thought was the highlight of their case while ignoring the problem.
Is it almost kind of like one of those instinctual things that a lot of children do, adults can do too, that are not super evolved? It's let's get louder. Like, if you're not hearing me, it's not that I'm not going to make my argument stronger. I'm just going to amplify my volume. I'm going to get more shocking. I'm going to make you hurt more. That's kind of how it read to me. It's like, oh, this isn't really working. Well, let's bring out this. Let's bring out that trick. Let's bring out the autopsy photos. Things that are not in question here about this case. Let's traumatize you guys. Then are you going to take my side? Then are you going to believe what I'm saying? That's kind of how it felt on the outside looking in. How does that land when that sort of argument is pushed onto a jury of, I'm just going to make you feel it more?
I had that happen in a very serious child death case where I was representing the defendant. He did not do it. We prevailed, not guilty on all counts. But during it, the prosecution, they had other huge holes in their case that they were just ignoring. And instead, they were like, hey, let me show you 40 autopsy photos of this two-month-old with their skull cut open with a saw. And let's look at their brain. And let me show you all this blood. And so on closing argument, I said, hey, these are scare tactics. They're trying to scare you into convicting because they're compensating for the evidence they don't have. So they're trying to get into your emotions and freak you out such that you'll be like, ah, this is such a scary scenario. I better err on the side of caution and convict. And so I blow them up in closing argument for those kinds of strategies, but they happen all the time.
I'm curious also, Eric, I don't know, you probably haven't been able to sit and watch the entire thing because you're actually doing work every day. But from what you've been seeing online and just through your own analysis, what do you think from what you see and how you've seen the prosecution play this, what do you think they think their strength is in this case?
I think they think their strength is sort of the premeditation. There are some suspicious circumstances in terms of, gossip. A person tells their partner to leave the house because they don't want to be caught or stopped in doing some act that they're planning on doing. Well, that looks shady. That doesn't look good. And so I think the evidence of premeditation, and, if I were them, I would have gone through exactly all of the actions Lindsey Clancy had to take to accomplish this. You talk about, I won't get too graphic, but you talk about you go down to where the children are, you grab the band, you affix it in your hands such that you're going to use it, you apply it to the child, you apply pressure until that child, doesn't breathe anymore, and then you do that three more times. That's a lot of steps, man.
At what point, it's a really good, fair point, if the premeditation action obviously is their strong point on this, because there's some actions they can say through internet searches, through sending Patrick out, and through exactly this, because they actually had the forensic experts get up there and talk about how long it takes to perish from strangulation and what it takes to do that and to do it three times. It's graphic. What balance do you think they could, should they have done more on that? because you got to ride that balance between what's the impact on the jury? Is it because these prosecutors seem to have a lack of self-awareness at times from seeing the coldness and callousness of their approach to the jury, I think, a little insensitive to some of the things they've done. Should they have done more on that? Like, where do you think that balance would have been?
I think it would make sense to go through all those steps I mentioned and be like, is this a person who's so out of their mind that they're flailing about? They can't control their body. They don't know what they're doing. That they're just, you know, acting on pure base visceral impulse and whatever. Or is this a person who had to take probably 20 plus steps in terms of specific actions in order to accomplish the death of these three children? And if so, that starts to look a little more like somebody who is knowingly engaging in action as opposed to just somebody who's, you would be bouncing off the walls in a crazy house.
And then you get Reddington step up there with Dr. Resnick, who completely explained exactly how that works. So it was a good day.
Every prosecution witness who personally knew Lindsay, Patrick, her friends or coworkers, told the jury the same thing under cross, that she was a wonderful mother, that she was loving, that she was, you know, she was great, you know, when she was had a healthy brain. We've seen so many cases where the prosecution, you know, parades out a lot of people who have a lot of nasty things to say about the person in question. Why do you think we didn't see any of those paraded out in this case?
You know, I'll be interested to see, because there are some rules that would prohibit the prosecution in their case in chief. Anyway, from calling a witness to kind of talk about character traits of the defendant. Typically, you can't do that unless you get prior court approval. For example, if the defendant, just hypothetically, was very violent, they attack people, they punch and kick people, things like that, you could bring such a witness to do that. But what they might do, Tony, is they might do that on their rebuttal case. Yeah. So after the defense is done, they might say, oh, you know, the defense talked about her character for peacefulness or her character for being nurturing. Well, we got some folks who are going to tell you the opposite of that about Lindsay Clancy. If they had such witnesses, it might come out of redirect or rebuttal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if they exist, I mean, my gut and the case is still ongoing, obviously. There's room for that to happen on the stage, but will it? Do they exist?
There's no wobble yet.
There's no wobble. There's nobody on talk shows. I mean, for all of the directions that this case is going in social media and media, wouldn't we have heard some of them on somebody's show at this point talking about what a monster Lindsay Clancy is? I mean, people are going down that road seeking verification of their assumption of who she is. And we've yet to get anybody who actually knew the woman to say that.
You know, it's kind of interesting, you know, we talk about that. I've thought about this so much, this way too much, this case in the last couple of weeks. It's fascinating to watch people argue against what the family and friends are saying about Lindsay. And I thought about this because I thought about this a lot too. What would it take me? And I try to be as critical thinking as possible, open-minded, live in the world of maybe. And I asked myself this question last night. What would it take me, even at this point right now, to say, I think she's guilty? And here's what it would be. It doesn't take much for me to start exploring more. It would take one, even better if you have two people, to do just that. Show me someone in her inner circle that gives a wobble, that says, you know what, that wasn't my experience with her. I'm going to direct my attention there, and I'm going to deep dive and explore that. Have them back up what their testimony is saying. Have them back up what their experts are saying. But you know, they were unable to do that. That's why I'm not wobbling, because no one else is. And it doesn't take much for me to redirect and be very open-minded to something else as a possibility. But to our point on this case, I don't think there is anyone. I've never seen this before. So here's what you typically get. You either get noise against from all these extra wobbles. You get the Lindsay situation, where I've never seen this on one of the cases we've covered before. Or you have silence, like in Laurie Daybell Valor or something like that, or even Corey Richens, you know, where you have maybe one or two people for, a couple people against, and just you're deafened by the silence that no one wants to speak on their behalf. This is so completely different.
Yeah. How different? Go ahead, Eric. just briefly that, you know, if she was this child killing monster that the prosecution claims she is, I gotta imagine there'd be one person in her life who would be like, yeah, she's dangerous, or she is not how these other folks have described it, and we have just not heard from any such person.
And that's the word I've seen people online using. She's dangerous. She's a manipulator. Watch out for her.
Yeah.
Who in her life has said that? The people that don't know her say that. I'm like, who are you to second guess her doctors, her psychiatrist? I mean, even her doctors aren't saying, they're just saying they didn't know. They're not saying she wasn't. They just didn't know. It's just, I'm sorry, I'm getting on my soapbox.
No, I know. How difficult is it going to be for a jury to understand the concept here of it's the state that has to prove that she was mentally competent, that she understood what wrong was? Because wrong here in this case, it's very much in the context of you know, what Lindsay was processing in her mind at that moment in time. When you're hearing the voice of God tell you, you know, not saying it's the voice of God, it's the psychotic delusion that she's having, that you need to take your kids out because they'll be better off if they're gone before you leave the planet, and you're then planning to leave it as well. And this is what the voice of God is telling you. I mean, that's like one hell of a transcendent experience. One is believing they're happening. It kind of overrides all earthly rules and laws, I would believe, if that's what you're thinking is happening. So she may have been in a state where, yes, by earthly laws and rules, you don't kill your kids. But when God's coming to you, well, that's what you got to follow. So I could see you being in a psychotic state, recognizing, yes, by moral standards and decency and everything, this is wrong. But God's coming to me in my head right now, so I got to follow.
And I'm going to follow up with that, because I watched Resnick testify just a little while ago. That wasn't just a command hallucination. According to him, she suffered from physical command. He said that in that state, they become incapable of stopping their physical actions as well. That's what he testified.
Yeah, and I think it's so critical for defense to hammer on that burden you mentioned, Tony. So in a lot of states, in this kind of case, the defense would have some burden to show that they didn't know, couldn't tell right from wrong. That's really hard to prove. Here it's the opposite. Prosecution, they've got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she knew right from wrong, and that's going to be very hard with this Resnick testimony.
Yeah. I don't know how they do it. I mean, this just seems to be almost like a textbook definition of someone who is not in their right mind. And here's why. I don't know how you walk away asking people to go see it the other way. Unless they just weren't watching, or it comes down to mortal sin. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts as we continue to follow this case as it gets closer to its conclusion. We'll continue our conversation right there. That'll wrap it up for us for today. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank
and Robin
so much,
Drake, his latest book, It's Not All About Me. Go check it out. Get it wherever you get books. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Or on Amazon. Go in and check that out. So used to saying Apple Podcasts. Anyway, and Robin has some interesting news next week. So
yes,
stay
we got
tuned.
A big drop coming next week. Can't wait
big
to share with
things
you.
Things are happening. So that's next week. So tune in. All right. Until next time, for Robin, for Eric, for Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.